Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Michael Gordon, who is the chief military correspondent of the New York Times, where he has worked since 1985. He has covered the Iraq War, the American interventions in Afghanistan, the Kosovo conflict, the Russian War in Chechnya, the 1991 Persian Gulf War, and the American invasion of Panama. With General Bernard E. Traynor, he has just written Cobra II, the inside story of the invasion and occupation of Iraq. Michael, welcome to Berkeley.
Nice to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
New York City.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, my father worked at the United Nations, and really for the first 15 years of the United Nations. So I kind of grew up in a milieu which there was always some discussion of international politics in the media, because my father had worked for CBS Radio at a point in time. So that was a big part of it.
So when did you get the bug to become a journalist?
Well, I had a kind of an odd path as a child of the 60s, and I actually was at Columbia University, and I got a master's degree in philosophy, of all things.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized I had to make a course correction and do something which did lead to employment. And so I went to the Columbia Journalism School and got a degree there and began reporting on the United Nations, actually, for a small monthly publication put out by the United Nations Association.
Mm-hmm. And what led you to this path to really become somebody who focuses on the Pentagon and American wars?
Well, after 3 years of covering UN issues, basically Namibia, collection of things that come before the Security Council, I ended up down in Washington working for a magazine called National Journal, which is a very serious magazine, has holes in it, you keep it in a binder forever. And basically what I covered was political economy and international trade, and I worked with a guy named Bob Samuelson, who's now the economics columnist at Newsweek. And after a couple years down there, Ronald Reagan was elected president, and the National Journal was looking for someone to cover the Pentagon. It was obvious to me that that was going to be a growth area because of, President Reagan was going to put a lot of money into it. And so I came in knowing basically nothing about the military or the Pentagon, just sort of started from scratch.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, this portfolio is a terribly important one. And if you were advising students, what would you tell them about the skills, the temperament needed to become a military correspondent?
Well, I think that in any of these fields in journalism, it's important that whatever field of endeavor you pick, you sort of stick with it. And there's an unfortunate tendency in journalism for people to become generalists. And they move around and they kind of punch their ticket. They'll do a couple years at the Pentagon, a couple years at the White House, then they'll go abroad. I can't criticize that entirely since I went to Moscow for 4 years, but they become adept at doing a lot of different things for short periods. But I think it's important in journalism that people specialize to a certain extent. And you have people who, if they're going to cover the military, at least focus on that and go to a few wars and become conversant with it. Or if you're going to cover aviation, there was a New York Times reporter, Dick Witkin, had a pilot's license. Or if you're going to cover labor, focus on that. I think that that's key because these areas are very complex. To recover them well requires some nuance. And that's lost if people just rotate among different beats.
I'm curious, to what extent did you benefit from having this philosophy background and not a journalism background in your education?
Well, when I first shifted into the national security arena, a big focus of mine was arms control and, the various negotiations with the Soviets on the intermediate-range missiles, long-range missiles. I broke a couple stories about intelligence re-estimates of the capability of Soviet missiles. So, from philosophy to arms control is not that great a leap. How many warheads can stand on the head of a pin? It's a bigger shift when you go to combat operations.
So I'm curious as to how if one reads this list of the wars that you've covered and the timing of your moving to this work. I mean, it seems there have been a lot of small conflicts and a lot of changes in the military. So I'm curious, how has the beat changed once you had that beat? How would you help us understand that?
Well, the beat's changed in a couple ways. One, you know, when I first started, the military really tried to keep the media at arm's length when it came to the war. Mm-hmm. And this was a reflection of the tensions between the media and the military in the Vietnam War. And so, for example, well, take the first Gulf War. There was some completely dysfunctional pool system, but basically the journalists were kept outside looking in. And in the current day, we've really gone, they have a practice called embedding, where you live among the forces. Mm-hmm. It's really the only way to do it. It's not the only way to do it, but it's an important way to do it. It's really the old model. It goes back to the way it was done in Vietnam and in World War II even. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge difference, because to cover a war from within a U.S. military unit and to experience what the troops and the officers experience and to have those sorts of insights is a much, I think, you know, gives you a much deeper understanding of the situation than if you're simply, you know, not with the forces and then kind of sweep in afterwards and try to reconstruct what happened.
Mm-hmm. There is a perception, especially in a place like Berkeley, that in fact embedding leads to the compromising of the journalism integrity. So this is another view that you're expressing here, and it's really an important one. So you get a feel, really, for what's happening, and you're able to talk to soldiers at all levels to really understand what's happening.
You know, there's a risk in journalism, regardless of what you cover. If you cover the White House, there's a risk that you'll become overly dependent on your sources and fear alienating mm-hmm. them. And you have to balance this risk in your own work to maintain your own credibility. Well, embedding doesn't change that. I mean, I don't think I know of any real examples where someone has been kicked out because they wrote something somebody didn't like. And in fact, I could cite a number of examples where embedded correspondents wrote things that were not particularly flattering to the unit they were with. But, you know, in the Iraq War, there wasn't much choice. There were people who went in unilaterally, and after being shot at a few times by the Fedayeen or the Iraqi military, they began to cling to the American forces and on the march up to Baghdad. So while they weren't sort of legally embedded, they were, you know, de facto embedded. But I do think it gives you an understanding of what the soldiers are really doing. I don't know how to cover something without covering it. Mm-hmm. So I don't understand the argument for not taking advantage of the opportunity to be in the battle when you want to write about the battle.
What in other areas of Pentagon information strategy has been the change over this period that you've been covering war? Has the Pentagon become more aggressive in trying to influence the perception of the way the war is perceived? What is your view of that, aside from the question of embedding journalists?
Well, I think, you know, the Pentagon, the Defense Department, is run by Civilian Defense Secretary, Secretary Rumsfeld. And I suppose from their perspective, they make efforts to influence public, you know, perceptions. They have press conferences, which Secretary Rumsfeld used to do himself to an extent. I hadn't really seen a defense secretary spend so much time behind the podium giving his own briefings, but he seems to enjoy doing it. But I don't think it's all that effective. And, you know, what the view from the field, by the way, is often at odds with the view at the Pentagon. And, for example, in the Cobra II book, I write about the tensions between the home office, so to speak, mm-hmm. and the field as to what's required by way of troops. So when reporters were embedded in the field, they didn't necessarily parrot the line coming out of the Pentagon. In fact, it was a lot different. The reporters in the field began writing about, hey, maybe there are not enough troops. Hey, there's a different kind of enemy out here than they've been telling us back at the Defense Department. You know, if the goal was to sort of, by the Defense Department, was to manipulate these reporters, I don't think it succeeded.
There's been an interesting evolution during this period of this relationship between military commanders and the civilian leaders in the Pentagon. It becomes very stark, and we'll talk about that in a minute, in the current Iraq war, and you describe it quite well in the book Cobra 2. But how has that changed? Has there always been this degree of tension between the commanders in the field and the leadership of the Pentagon?
No. I would say that in the Clinton administration, for better or for worse, they essentially deferred to the military. It wasn't always the right thing to do, but I think that they were much more willing to, you know, accept the input from the military instead of dictate from on high. I mean, a certain amount of tension is understandable. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're supposed to have a civilian oversight, you know, I don't want to exaggerate the tensions as, you know, at this point in time. But, you know, when Secretary Rumsfeld came to the Pentagon, he had a very kind of dim view of the U.S. Army leadership. He didn't think much of it. He thought the Army had too much of a Cold War focus. He didn't really, wasn't that interested in the view of the Joint Chiefs of Staff that he inherited. He thought there were Clinton generals and admirals, and they were unable to persuade them that there were no such thing as Clinton generals or admirals. They were just generals and admirals. And so those tensions were rife in the first year at the Pentagon. In fact, before the Iraq War and really before 9/11, there was even some speculation that Rumsfeld might leave the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned earlier the Vietnam and war and the lessons of that war and so on, and that has been an influence on the way the military has changed and the way it's perceived itself and so on. Talk a little about that, because the lessons learned from that war and the way they were implanted really affected the way the military changed after the end of the war, and how it saw the world when the Soviet Empire collapsed.
Well, it certainly had a profound influence, especially on people like Colin Powell, and who felt that Vietnam was a case in which the military was sort of left holding the bag. And I think the way it affected the military were in some very positive ways. I mean, it led to the establishment of a professional military, which has been a success. High-quality force, well-trained, you know, and using some very high-tech systems. Mm-hmm. I think that's been a plus. It led, though, also to a sense it led to a restructuring of the armed forces. For example, a lot of the essential capabilities of the military were put by design in the reserve component, and that was done by the military after Vietnam, because President Johnson was reluctant to call up the reserves. And so the theory was, look, if we ever go to war again, the president's going to have to call up reserves because he's not going to be able to fight the war without them, and therefore we'll have the country behind us. It actually backfired a little bit in this war because the reserves, the National Guard, have been run ragged because they provide a lot of the civil affairs, the essential support, logistical support that's needed for the war. I think, though, it also led on the part of people like Colin Powell to a view that, you know, we have to have overwhelming force. You know, we got to go in a clear exit strategy, and we'll go in with, you know, if one's good, three's better, and we're not going to go in until we know how we get out. And that was pretty much the doctrine that persisted in the first Bush administration and into the Clinton administration. When Rumsfeld came in, he tried to introduce a new approach, which had some merit to it, which he called transformation. But he thought that the military had become a little too enamored of, you know, big is beautiful, and we can't do anything unless we send half the army there, and we know exactly how we're getting out. And so he began pushing for an approach where, you know, a little simplistically, we'd have a sort of a leaner and meaner force. And because the Powell Doctrine was a little bit immobilizing at times, there are cases where you do want to use force, and you don't want to send six divisions and take 6 months to get ready. Well, Rumsfeld was a little bit of a reaction to it, but was a little bit of an overreaction to it.
Mm-hmm. To give Rumsfeld his due before we do the other side of that equation, he, I guess, had a sense that the military was prepared to fight the Cold War, the Soviet Army, and in the wake of the end of the Cold War, changes had not been made to take into account what the new technology offered in the way of possibilities for fighting war.
Well, I actually think changes were made, and I actually think all of the new technology that's been fielded in the current war was all designed and programmed prior to Rumsfeld taking over. Mm-hmm. He's just inherited these systems because the military was already going that way. But he did think that the military was not joined enough, meaning, you know, it wasn't integrated enough among the different services when they carried out operations. He particularly thought the Army was sort of stodgy and, you know, a little ponderous and too wedded to heavy forces. That was the attitude he had coming in. And, you know, the Pentagon was overdue for a little shaking up, at least a little intelligence shaking up.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess that before we get into what the goals were of the administration in this war and why they went awry, or at least their implementation did not succeed in the way they anticipated, what impact, looking back, do you see 9/11 having on all of this? Because there was clearly a learning curve during this period that you were covering wars by the military, by, you know, incumbent administrations, and then 9/11 hit. Did that sort of shake up the deck of cards in making it politically feasible to really take new directions?
Well, 9/11 led to the war in Iraq, rightly or wrongly. Mm-hmm. And without 9/11, there would have been no war in Iraq. Because when the Bush administration entered office, they had an attitude on Iraq. They felt it was a problem that needed to be tended to. In fact, in a meeting that the president-elect Bush had with President Clinton, they discussed their priorities. And President Clinton said his priority was Middle East peace and then dealing with North Korea and dealing with Al-Qaeda, and Iraq was at the bottom. And then President Clinton said, well, for you, you know, meaning President-elect Bush, he said, I think your priorities are missile defense in Iraq. And he was right. Mm-hmm. But that said, they were not determined to invade Iraq. And I've looked at the meetings and discussions that were held over the summer of 2001, and I would say, absent 9/11, probably the most the U.S. would have done would have been to try to sponsor some sort of Shia rebellion in the South, maybe arm them and provide air cover, the Wolfowitz plan, basically. Certainly a major invasion with ground forces. There really wasn't the political support for it. The administration wasn't focused on that. It was 9/11 that kind of provided the political window of opportunity and for the administration to pursue that agenda.
And so let's move into your new book now, and I want to show our audience the cover again, Cobra 2, a really kind of impressive rendering of the war and its failures. And let me begin by asking you this. What were the goals of the administration in going to Iraq, and who were the influential players?
Well, there are only three players, major players on the civilian side: President Bush, Vice President Cheney, and Defense Secretary Rumsfeld. Everyone else is a secondary character. I mean, Condoleezza Rice was essentially coordinator, as National Security Advisor, not an essential figure in actually formulating the policy. Secretary of State Powell was largely shut out and blindsided by decisions. So those three, this troika, are the three like-minded, you know, almost joined at the hip, shared many of the same assumptions, reinforced each other's assumptions. They decided the main policy direction, and General Franks was kind of a willing cohort and shared in their vision.
How would you characterize that troika? We've just talked about 9/11 is hit. So what in their backgrounds led them to the direction that they took before we actually talk about the goals that they had in mind?
Well, they weren't neocons, and now the much maligned neocons, mm-hmm. or there were neocons in administration, but they also were secondary figures. I think that they took different directions. I think that for Vice President Cheney, you know, at the end of the Gulf War, he thought that Saddam would fall of his own weight. I know that because he told me that in an interview I did for him from my previous book, The General's War. We even had a bet on it, which I've yet to collect. And he said
after this book, he may not want to pay.
I tried to collect during the course of writing the book because I thought I could get an interview out of it, but I was unable to collect. And the but that, his expectation was Saddam would fall of its own weight, and then he didn't. And then I think what he saw was Iraq was still a problem. The American intelligence indicated they were still pursuing WMD. And I think that Cheney, based on his previous experience, and I'm putting kind of thoughts in his mind, I'm just trying to read how he would have saw the situation. I think he asked himself the question, what if the Persian Gulf War had occurred and Saddam had a nuclear weapon? And he had taken Kuwait. Would we have kicked him out of Kuwait? I don't think so. So I think he saw preventing Saddam from acquiring a nuclear weapon as really a very important strategic objective. And, you know, from Cheney's point of view, you know, how close he was to this, whether it was 10 years or 5 years or 20 years, almost didn't matter. The Bush administration was in power for those 4 years, and I think he saw it was up to them to intervene.
So, and I think you've made an important point, which I want to just emphasize to our audience, which is that the fear was that if Saddam had a nuclear weapon, that he could deter us in our response to some action that he might take in the region, that we would fear starting a nuclear war in the region, and then therefore not act to stop whatever he might do.
Well, you know, I can't tell you that Cheney, you know, explicitly believed this, but if you read his speeches, he was very much concerned with the nuclear issue. And I think that, and as somebody who was the defense secretary for the first war, I think he had to have asked himself that question. And I think he was a little fed up. I mean, here's a man who had been defeated in the war, Saddam, and he was still around. And their sense was the sanctions were eroding. Saddam hadn't given up his ambitions. He was still trying to get back into the WMD game at some point. I think from Cheney's point of view, it was enough was enough. So I think he came around. He was one of those people in the first Bush administration who favored ending the war at 100 hours, made the case against going to Baghdad in public debate. I know because I asked him, and he gave me all the reasons not to do it, but who changed his view over time. I think for Secretary Rumsfeld, he had a different approach. He, of course, wasn't in the first administration. But after 9/11, he felt that intervention in Afghanistan was sort of necessary but not sufficient to show that America was back. And we had lost, you know, all the people who died in the World Trade Center and in the Pentagon, and now we were taking out the Taliban. What's the Taliban? You know, a bunch of guys in Toyota pickup trucks who drive around and, you know, Wes Clark, the former NATO commander, once told me he thought they were the most incompetent enemy since the Barbary pirates. So I think that from Rumsfeld's point of view, he said, fine, take out the Taliban. But that's not enough. There has to be another step in what they called the global war on terror to show that nobody can take for American for granted, that, you know, we're going to root out threats to our country. And I think Iraq kind of became almost a convenient target for this. I mean, it was hard to find al-Qaeda. The capital of Baghdad wasn't going anywhere, and neither was Saddam. So I think for Rumsfeld, it was he wanted a demonstration of American power. And also, you know, he had no love for Saddam, and Saddam was a thorn in their side. So I think that's how he came to it. And I think President Bush, he's a very different figure than his father, and he was much more attuned to the unilateral use of force, much less respectful of the United Nations and multilateral institutions. And I think an important factor here is their first war was Afghanistan, and it worked, more or less. There are some residual problems, but it worked. And they didn't use a lot of forces, and they didn't mount a major nation-building effort. And yet they got in, they toppled the regime, a pro-American government took root there, and, you know, they moved on from there. And I think this also colored their experience, and they began to think, gee, we did it in Afghanistan, it looks, you know, and it wasn't that hard. Mm-hmm. I think we can do this in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. So coming to this decision at this point, then a key element becomes, how do we make the war plan, and how many troops do we need on the ground to do this? So I think what you're saying in the book is that it comes together in what they see as a plan that will build on the Afghan experience on the one hand, but will also be a way to implement what we have just talked about, namely to make use of the revolution in military affairs. Talk a little about that that plan.
Well, what's striking is the offensive planning begins in earnest, I would say, around December 2001. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, bin Laden's still running around in his caves in Tora Bora or across the border in Afghanistan, and they're already beginning to put together a concept for how to do the Iraq war. General Franks has written about this in his book, and he went down to Crawford and talked to the president about this. But, you know, he comes in with some forces, and, you know, the plan they had on the shelf called, which General Zinni had left behind, called for 380,000 troops. The reason it called for so many troops is General Zinni wanted to lock down the entire country and control it. Well, General Franks' initial submissions to Secretary Rumsfeld were sort of sons of this plan, you know, not quite as many, but consistent with the spirit of that plan. Well, Rumsfeld was very unhappy with this. This was kind of old think as far as he was concerned. And what ensued was a process of what Rumsfeld calls iterative planning, but what Newt Gingrich, who was an advisor to Rumsfeld, calls a negotiation, where Rumsfeld was constantly pressing, it's got to be smaller, it's got to be faster. By the way, the president did that too. He wanted something to deploy more quickly. And the military was coming back and saying, okay, it can be smaller, but can't be too small. We still have all these tasks to perform. And this kind of back and forth went on for, easily a year. Mm-hmm. And it was like an accordion. It got bigger, it got smaller, it got bigger again.
The number of troops. The troops kept going down.
Well, no. It actually, the troops, what happened was, interestingly enough, is I know all these plans, you know, inside out, but they started out with something called the Generated Start, which is about 5+ divisions, and that was too big for Rumsfeld, and they came up with a variant called the Running Start, where you begin maybe with a division or so, and then the reinforcements would flow behind it. So you start small, but you just keep sending more of what you need. And then General McKiernan, who was a land war commander, came in, and he took over his assignment in really September 2002, and he looked at this thing and said, wait a second, this is too small. You know, here, small is not beautiful. And he lobbied to make it bigger again, and he did. It wasn't General Franks who wrote the war plan. It was General McKiernan, in my judgment, who was the principal architect. Mm-hmm. He said, I just can't live with this. Mm-hmm. You know, as small as the plan was, it would have been smaller still mm-hmm. without the intervention of General McKiernan. And so that went on until December 2002. So there was this constant pulling back and forth. What's really striking is while, you know, there's well over a year of offensive planning, the post-war planning doesn't begin in earnest to really, I would say, January, February 2003. So you're planning the offensive campaign, invasion, phase three, what they called it, the march to Baghdad. It's phase three, major combat operations, for, you know, somewhere on the order of, well, some of it actually, early work was done in October of 2001, you know, 18 months. And the but the phase four, the post-war mm-hmm. operations, 2 months. Mm-hmm. You know, it was exactly the opposite of what ought to have been done, mm-hmm. because my view is you could have attacked Iraq from north, south, east, west. The United States military is going to beat the Iraqi military. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be a serious contest. The part that's difficult is the day after problem.
Mm-hmm. And that was the reason that so many of these different plans, and it wasn't just one plan that said, or one person that was saying, well, we need, you know, 300,000 plus troops. There were several such arguments out there and plans, Zinni. I think you mentioned that the NSC will also had some papers that recommended this, but those plans took into account the need for post-conflict stabilization. That was a big reason for the numbers that were desired in those alternative plans.
We had enough troops to get to Baghdad and to take down the regime, although there were a few hairy moments along the way, but the number of forces was sufficient. They were able to take advantage of technology and American air superiority and the superior training of U.S. troops. But the big issue was a principle that's well understood in the U.S. Army. You need more people to control the country afterwards than you need to take down the enemy regime. It's the troop-to-task ratio, as they call it. Iraq is the size of California. The borders are porous. You might want to close them, either to stop WMD from going out, since that's what they thought they had, or to stop jihadists from coming in, because they could, you know, disrupt your efforts, just to control the place and provide security. And when General Shinseki was asked, the Army Chief of Staff was asked by the Congress, he said several hundreds of thousands. I mean, the point he was making was you don't need them to win the war, you need them to control the country afterwards. And, you know, when the RAND Corporation, for example, looked at these sorts of things, they came up with similar numbers. And there was a study done on the NSC staff by a young Marine, Jeff Kojak. And he can't make recommendations to the president. So what he did is he said, well, here are the different post-war situations. And if you used the Balkans as a model, he looked at how many troops we had in Balkans, what the population was, what the size of the territory was, and you use those sorts, applied those ratios to Iraq, you get troop requirements in the order of 300,000 to 400,000. Mm-hmm. But what the administration did is they said, well, we don't want to look at the Balkans. That was the Clinton administration. We don't agree with that anyway. We want to look at Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. That was our early experience. Well, the problem is Afghanistan and Iraq are such different strategic cases that if you look at Afghanistan, you say, well, we hardly put anything in there, and that place held together. Well, that's true, but that has no relevance whatsoever for the situation in Iraq. So there were people who were cautioning them. And, you know, even Paul Wolfowitz publicly disputed the notion that you would require more forces to pacify a country than to defeat the regime. You ask any Army officer, everybody understands that.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the next stage of the war, the plan is implemented, we go to war, and one of the startling revelations in your book is the soldiers on the ground, especially the Corps 5 commander, saw pretty quickly that the war plan that we had wasn't going to work. What was the response that you reveal in the book by the higher echelons, the civilian echelons in the Pentagon?
Well, the concept of the enemy that they had at CENTCOM, Chemmy Franks' command, and in the Pentagon, was basically a replay of the last war. You're going to fight the Republican Guard, you defeat them, you take Baghdad, war is over. And the intelligence on the situation in southern Iraq was also very deficient. But when the forces crossed into southern Iraq, they were soon involved in fierce battles in Nasiriya, Asamoah, on the Jaf. You know, fights that, to this day, I don't think the American public appreciates just how tough some of those fights were. They seem to have the notion that they just drove to Baghdad and then had a battle for a couple of days and the war ended. It wasn't that way at all. And all the principal field commanders understood that this was a different situation and also a different enemy than they had been led to expect. This was not the Republican Guard. It wasn't even the regular army. This was a paramilitary force called the Saddam Fedayeen, established by Saddam primarily to suppress the Shia and prevent an uprising. They didn't wear uniforms, were equipped with RPGs, small arms, thousands of them, huge caches of arms in these towns. Well, and fanatical, prepared to fight really to the end. Well, what happened was General Wallace, the 5th Corps commander, and General Conway, the Marine commander, General McKiernan, the overall Allied Land War commander, they all had a meeting in Jalaba Air Base, and they decided among themselves that, look, we can't just continue to march to Baghdad. We're getting hit in our supply lines. These guys are coming out to threaten our logistics. We got to deal with this. We got to pause this attack to Baghdad for a few days and just cope with these fedayeen. There was no disagreement there. There was some, you know, how long, maybe some differences, but on the principle that you had to pause and deal with it, everybody agreed at that level, this three-star level. General Franks, back in Qatar, you know, not Iraq, where his command was headquartered, he didn't see it that way, and neither did Secretary Rumsfeld, in my judgment. And so they were unhappy with this pause, and they discounted this fedayeen threat. They said, they basically considered the fedayeen a distraction or a speed bump on the way to Baghdad. They wanted to press onwards. At least the reaction of General Wallace began to talk somewhat publicly about this decision, and he gave a pretty famous interview to a reporter from the New York Times and the Washington Post, where he said, we're going to pause. We're going to deal with this threat that we hadn't anticipated, and then we'll continue. When I heard General Wallace make those remarks, I thought, well, nothing surprising there. But General Franks' reaction was he threatened to fire General Wallace and had to be talked out of it. So this was an important moment because, in my judgment, had General Franks and had Secretary Rumsfeld correctly read the developments on the battlefield, they would have come to the conclusion that there was an enemy out there that was not likely to go away with the fall of Baghdad. That would be, at a minimum, a thorn in our side, and perhaps more than that. And therefore, we need to prepare to deal with this. And they would have continued to send reinforcements. And what they did was, as the forces continued to get to Baghdad, they stopped sending the reinforcements and began to pocket their victory. If they had paid attention to this fedayeen force, they would have said, don't know what's going to happen. Don't know where these people are going to be exactly after Baghdad falls. But we better send some more troops and the right type of troops to deal with it. And, you know, this is one of the pitfalls of transformation, Rumsfeld's emphasis on a high-tech military, which has many positive elements, but they literally look on a computer screen. I've seen them. Mm-hmm. And we're the blue guys, blue team, which is always the good guys of the blue force. The enemy is the red force. And the Republican Guard divisions, they get an icon on that computer screen. There's something for the Medina Division, the Hammurabi Division, the Al-Nidal Division, and the regular Army Division, the 10th and 6th. They have red icons. And you look on that screen and you think, we got to get those guys. While paramilitary guys driving around in pickup trucks, they don't get an icon. Mm. And so if you're sitting back in Qatar like General Franks was, or at the Pentagon like Secretary Rumsfeld was, and if you're relying on this computer representation of the battlefield, you're missing what's happening on the battlefield. Mm. And when the blue icons don't move, you may come to the conclusion they're not fighting. Mm-hmm. Well, they are fighting. They're fighting these other guys who don't even have an icon.
Yeah. So you really don't get the information about what is going on the ground, which is what information systems are supposed to make possible under the revolution of military affairs.
And if your mentality, as Secretary Rumsfeld's mm-hmm. mentality was, is that the Army's too Cold War, too cautious, they're ponderous, they always want more troops, and then your generals start talking about pausing, you're inclined to say, oh, this is another example of how the U.S. Army is risk-averse, instead of saying, wait a second, we hadn't thought of this. We need to adapt.
Mm-hmm. Now, what you're saying is that the war, the conduct of the war that led to military victory in the third phase created the situation for a stalemate in the fourth phase when stabilization occurs. Now, another element in this that you emphasize that becomes very important is Bremer's decision to abolish the Iraqi army. Talk about that, because then you couldn't turn to those forces to use them in the post-conflict stabilization effort.
Well, I don't think there's any one factor that led to the insurgency. I think that the misreading of the battlefield was one, because it led Secretary Rumsfeld and General Franks to cancel the deployment of a division that was otherwise due to go to Iraq, and left General McKiernan without the 1st Cavalry Division. So, you know, instead they didn't even send all the divisions allocated under the plan because they discounted this threat on the battlefield. I think that's a factor. I think the aversion to nation building, in the sense that it created unhealthy dependencies by the host population on the intervening force. Rumsfeld gave a speech on this in New York 1 month before the war, you know, beyond nation building. So they didn't want, we didn't want to provide the police. Mm-hmm. This is not a sin of omission, this is a sin of commission. Yeah. We didn't want to provide the police. We weren't prepared to deal with the electrical grid. They were going to do this based on the export of the oil. Fine, that's plan A. But if plan A doesn't work out, what's plan B? They didn't have a plan B. But then Ambassador Bremer came in. And as an extension of his debathification policy, he promulgated an edict to disestablish the Iraqi army. I have to tell you, the American military was against this, especially the way Bremer did it. They were counting on using the Iraqi army as an ally and trying to establish control because they knew they didn't have enough troops. So now Secretary Rumsfeld has limited the number of American troops by canceling the 1st Cavalry Division and misreading the battlefield, and General Franks acquiesced in that. The Iraqi population is becoming a bit alienated because we can't meet their needs in terms of basic services. Bremer is essentially limiting the number of Iraqi troops. This is creating a security vacuum and also in which an insurgency gradually began to take hold.
Mm-hmm. Now, in all of this, in addition to the failure of the plan, the willful blindness, I will call it, of the civilian leadership, another problem that you really give us a very sharp picture of is the failure of intelligence. That I think you're suggesting that the reliance on technology did not have what you quote one officer as saying a granular feel on the ground. So that, and this failure was not just the weapons of mass destruction failure, but a failure to know what everything from what Saddam's plan was in response to our attack, to not knowing physically where he was, to not knowing what the state of the infrastructure was, and on and on.
I think the intelligence performance was just abysmal, and it cost American lives. What happened was WMD was only a part of it. You know, people often say there's a failure by analysts to connect the dots. Well, in Iraq, the problem was we just didn't have enough dots. Mm-hmm. We didn't have enough operatives or agents in Iraq to provide credible information about WMD. I mean, it's emerged that the CIA didn't have a single agent with direct access to Saddam's WMD efforts, okay? They also didn't have reliable agents in the South, despite the many millions of dollars they threw around. And in Afghanistan, they had such people, because there was a long history of, you know, the Russians invaded, the CIA worked with the Mujahideen to fight them and provide them with Stinger missiles. They had a whole host of relationships. Well, they didn't have these relationships in Iraq. They had to recreate them. Actually, they had to create them. And so they were reporting back to the military that the South was ours, basically, that there would be anti-Saddam tribes would assist in seizing objectives, that units would capitulate en masse and surrender to the Americans. They even had a plan, which actually didn't get implemented, but it was a serious plan in the eyes of the CIA to distribute American flags in these towns so that people could wave them at the American forces as they went in, and that the pictures could be taken of this. And in fact, one of the memorable moments comes when the 37 Cavalry Squadron had a very an excellent commander, Terry Farrell, was coming approaching Samoa, and you know they're encountering the Fedayeen. And they're trying to sort out what this is all about. And he gets on the radio, and he said, you know, there's no parade. People are trying to shoot us. You know, well, why did they think there might be a parade in the first place? Because this was a kind of an intelligence failure on the part of the CIA. So that was a big part of it. And you know, the forces, the U.S. forces who go into Nasiriyah and all these towns, you know, they're learning as they go because they had very poor intelligence to prepare them for what they encountered.
Mm-hmm. And Saddam himself really was focused on rebellion in the South, hence the need for the Fedayeen. He was focused on the threat, the potential threat from Iran. And we totally misread all of that.
Well, for all the American miscalculations, Saddam's miscalculations were far worse. So what you have here are two sides that utterly misread the other side's kind of political and military strategy. Mm-hmm. And are now have an outcome that neither side anticipated. Saddam's view was the Americans would never go to Baghdad. He simply thought the United States didn't have the will to do it. I mean, this was his reading of the debacle in Somalia and even Kosovo, you know, where the U.S. waged an air war but didn't want to get in on the ground. And he was concerned first and foremost about the Shia. Quite reasonable. They rose up in 91. And he thought, well, if the Americans, he thought the Americans could attack, but it would be airstrikes that might intervene in the southern part of his country, and the Shia would use this as an opportunity to rise up. He was so concerned about this that he wouldn't let his generals destroy bridges without his explicit authority. Why? Because he needed to use the bridges to rush forces south to fight the Shia. Mm-hmm. Well, it was a great benefit to the advancing American army because they used these same bridges to go to Baghdad. And in terms of an external enemy, his primary enemy that he saw, ironically, is the very same one that the White House now sees, Iran, which does have WMD programs. And this is very important. One reason Saddam was not willing to come completely clean on his absence of WMD was he didn't want to reveal his weakness to the Iranians, with whom he had fought an 8-year war. So his policy was to comply with the UN inspections, let them go wherever they want to go, but never really come clean. And this was one of his a Republican Guard commanders, General Hamdani, called this strategy deterrence by doubt. I mean, Hans Blix, the UN weapons inspector, later had a phrase for it. He said, "You don't have to have a dog to hang a sign outside your house that says, 'Beware of dog.'" And that's kind of what Saddam was doing, but it backfired on him in Washington, mm-hmm. because his efforts to preserve some ambiguity over his holdings, his non-existent holdings of WMD, were perceived by the CIA and by the White House as a proof that he was hiding something.
The neoconservatives don't play a role really very much in this account, which is a military history and a fair reflection of what were the forces that led us to this outcome. But the one place where, and it's almost like a Marx Brothers movie in the middle of this great story of the war, and that is the decision at the last minute to bring Chalabi in with a small number of his soldiers. Well, not to bring him in, but to bring his soldiers in so there could be an Iraqi face to the invasion. And then at the last minute, without anyone's knowledge, not the military commanders, apparently our military commanders, Chalabi himself was flown in. Talk a little about that, because he was kind of the embodiment of the neoconservative idea that this would become a transformation of Iraq.
Well, it's a really odd episode that I was able to report on the record, because I interviewed the American military officer who was the liaison with Chalabi. And an American Army colonel, Ted Seal, was assigned to be with Chalabi and his fighters as a liaison officer. And every day he would get on the phone and report back to CENTCOM the status of Chalabi's fighters, unvetted. A lot of them were from Iran, by the way, you know, Iraqis who had fled to Iran. And one day he gets an instruction to call General Abizaid, who was now the Central Command commander, but he was then General Franks' deputy. And General Abizaid says, "Well, how many fighters does Chalabi have?" And this is at the time when we were coming up against the Fedayeen. It was getting a little tougher. The pause was going on. People were getting a little nervous about how this is going. And Colonel Seal said, "Well, I'll ask him. He's standing right next to me. He said, Ahmed, how many fighters do you have? He said, I have 1,000. So Seal gets on the phone. 700. They said, well, we'll fly him down there. And so it was agreed that they would be flown down to Tallil, and they would be kind of an Iraqi Free French type force, you know, the Iraqi freedom fighters. And they would join us, and they would speak the language at least, and they would be Iraqis, and forces that were you know, reluctant to surrender to the Americans might surrender to them. Well, it emerged during this that Chalabi also wanted to go, and General Abizaid hadn't bargained for that. And there was a discussion between him and Paul Wolfowitz where Chalabi said, well, he didn't want to introduce a would-be politician into Iraq and take sides. But Wolfowitz's point was basically, look, you're the guy that asked for his fighters, and the fighters want their leader. Mm. So they all do go down to Tallil. They end up playing no constructive role in the war whatsoever, and Chalabi uses the opportunity to go to Nasiriyah and start making speeches. It's one of the sort of little-known but very interesting kind of sub-themes in this war.
Looking back now, I'm curious, what do you think this experience, the history, the telling of all of these elements, what will be the consequences for the American military? Will there be a new version of the lessons of Vietnam, or what?
Well, because this war is still going on and will go on for years, the American military has studied many of these lessons and absorbed them and is trying to apply them. So, I mean, obviously they understand, they've taken a crash course in counterinsurgency operations and civil affairs, after Bremer's ill-advised decision to dissolve the Iraqi military, building up the Iraqi military is now top priority. They're spending vast sums on trying to do this. I think the people we have in Iraq now, General Casey and Zalmay Khalilzad, the American ambassador, would have been there earlier, except Jerry Bremer didn't want him there. I think they have a good relationship where their predecessors didn't. I think a lot of the kind of lessons have been learned and are being applied. But, the objective victory has been redefined in this war. Mm. And victory initially was we go in, we take out Saddam, a new government is established out of the rubble. They carry the main burden. Allies come in to do the main peacekeeping. Mm-hmm. We keep maybe a division there. General Franks' plan was to try to get it down to one American division by September 2003. Our forces are withdrawn, refit. We've taught an object lesson to the Iranians and the Syrians. That was the original goal. I think the second goal became, okay, there's an insurgency that we didn't anticipate. So now the second definition of victory is, well, we defeat this insurgency, and then we get back with the plan. Well, I think at this stage, the definition of victory has changed yet again. And it's, well, the insurgency is held at bay, and we transfer the primary role to fighting this insurgency to a newly established Iraqi military that we support, but we gradually reduce our force presence in Iraq. But this insurgency, this goes on for years, and yet somehow the government holds. That's the new definition of victory in this war.
What was the hardest thing to in writing this book? Because it's an extraordinary account of the war, which really relies on sources of information in the ground in the war, in Washington and so on. What was the greatest difficulty in consummating this work?
Well, it just, it's really like several books in one. It's like the first, I think it's 8 chapters, is really the policy kind of evolution of, how we went to war with Iraq, the confused post-war policy, a lot of the Washington wrangling, and it covers about 18 months. and then the ensuing, through up to from chapter, 9 through 22 is a war. It covers about a 3-week period, but I've chronicled in great detail a lot of these battles and how they were actually fought, because some of these battles no one's ever really covered to this day, because the embeds moved on. They moved on to the next assignment, the next battle, next place, and I had to kind of really put it all together. And then there's the post-war. I would say that some of these interactions are just so complex that, it's kind of linking what was happening on the battlefield to what was happening in Washington just required a lot of hard work to try to chase things down. And you know from this book also, and I feel strongly about this, there's a tendency now in book writing not to have footnotes, not to have original sources, not to put people on the record, not to put documents in the book. I'm fighting that tendency. I tried, couldn't do it in many cases, but I tried to put people on the record. And a lot of the generals went on the record. I try to have footnotes saying where some of this information came from. I try to put, like, the British representative in Baghdad, his cables back to London that I acquired that are confidential. I put them in the appendix of the book. Let people read for themselves. I tried to document to the extent I could where all of this came from. That said, it just simply wasn't possible to put everybody on the record despite my earnest efforts, because people, they're afraid of losing their job, they're afraid of hurting their chances for advancement. There's a whole host of reasons why people were reluctant to go on the record. So I think maybe the hardest part was just, I had some success in getting it on the record, but not complete success. But, I think it's important, and you've interviewed other authors. Go look at their footnotes in some recent books in Iraq. Some don't even have footnotes.
Mm-hmm. One final question, requiring a brief answer. If students were to watch this program, how would you advise them to prepare for a beat like military correspondent?
I don't think it's fundamentally different than being a medical correspondent or being a Supreme Court correspondent like Linda Greenhouse. I think you just got to dive into it and stick with it, and in your head, think of it as a 5 to 10 year kind of professional commitment. Don't think of it as a 5 month assignment, and you're just gonna go to a war and do a few kind of glossy reports and then bail out. Because I think it really does require that degree of commitment. To do successfully, A, it's very complicated subject matter. B, the military, it takes a while to gain the trust of people, and that's gained through repeated encounters with military officers and civilians, and that all takes time.
Michael, on that note, I want to thank you very much for coming to our program. Thank you very much for writing this book, which I will show to our audience again, Cobra, to the definitive account of the war up until the present. Thank you very much.
Right, thank you.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.